From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Vice President Mike Pence met with Turkey's President Erdogan for over an hour today after over a week of harsh words back in Washington over Turkey's incursion into northern Syria and President Trump's unilateral decision to pull troops out of the region, abandoning the U.S. allies, the Kurds. Yesterday, the House approved a resolution condemning the Trump administration's policy in Syria, and Democratic leaders walked out of a meeting on Syria with President Trump. All of this while the impeachment inquiry rolls on. The ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, is testifying before House investigators today. Let's bring in NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi there, Robin.
So we don't know yet that much about this meeting, but give us more context, because the president has been saying things like, this isn't our border, it's not our business, the Kurds weren't angels. And even some Republicans were saying that he ruined any chance that Pence might have had to arm twist Michelle Kellerman. Hi, Michelle. To stop the incursion.
Hi there, Robin.
And staying
with Sondland, the message from the president is it's not our problem. Let Russia and Turkey and the Kurds fight it out. I want to get out of the Middle East. At the same time, he sent Pence over there to get a ceasefire, to get the Turks to agree to a ceasefire. But Erdogan has told the Turkish parliament that he won't agree to a ceasefire until Turkey has established control over northern Syria. That's what they're doing right now with their military incursion. The president even sent that letter to Erdogan 3 days after the phone call, where he basically gave a green light to the Turks, where he said, don't be a fool, don't slaughter the Kurds, but Erdogan went right ahead. So it's unlikely that Erdogan would turn around and agree to a ceasefire right now.
We'll talk about the feeling in Washington, because I mentioned the House vote condemning the administration's policy in Syria. Over 100 Republicans joined that vote. What's the sense of what's going to happen from lawmakers?
Well, that's a really good question. The House vote was overwhelming, 354-60, to condemn the president's decision to pull out of Syria and to allow this to happen. And included in that 354 vote were the Republican leaders of the House, which is unusual. But Congress is talking about sanctions that might be tougher than the ones that the administration has talked about. This has been a very loud pushback from Republicans about this. In the past, they have felt more bold to criticize the president on foreign policy than on other issues, mostly because the Republicans' base doesn't care as much about foreign policy as they do about issues like immigration. They don't really know who the Kurds are. But also, I can tell you that some members of Congress are starting to think about the future, thinking about what, if anything, Congress could do proactively to make sure that, for instance, if Trump is reelected and he wants to pull the U.S. out of NATO with a tweet, or pull U.S. troops off the Korean Peninsula with a tweet, they're wondering what, if anything, could Congress do to stop that.
When the time we have, I really want to ask you about the ongoing impeachment inquiry. It's kind of stunning that these things are parallel. But we have Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland testifying before the House today. He's one of the self-described three amigos that say they were directing U.S. policy toward Ukraine, even though none of them had that in their portfolio. He's, you know, answering questions today. What are we hearing?
What we know is that as part of Gordon Sondland's opening remarks, he says, quote, inviting a foreign government to undertake investigations for the purpose of influencing an upcoming U.S. election would be wrong. He said withholding foreign aid in order to pressure a foreign government to do so would be wrong. He said he never participated in such undertakings. I think what he is doing in his testimony is trying to say, look, and I was trying to help Ukraine get the aid they needed.
Well, we knew in reports leading up to today that at least reports said that he was going to say that he had a phone call with the president, which the president told him to tell another concerned official that there was no quid pro quo.
Yes, he's not denying that the president told him that, but he's not saying there was no quid pro quo. He is merely saying the president told me there was no quid pro quo. He says he called the president directly. He said, I asked the president, what do you want from Ukraine? The president responded, nothing. There is no quid pro quo. The president repeated no quid pro quo multiple times. This was a very short call, and I recall the president was in a bad mood. And just to remember the timing of this, the call was on September 9th. On September 9th is when the House Intelligence Committee was informed about this whistleblower complaint, and the whole thing was beginning to come out in the public.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
A group of lawmakers from Northern Ireland is trying to put the brakes on a Brexit deal that Prime Minister Boris Johnson triumphantly announced this morning. Johnson said he reached a draft deal with foreign negotiators to break the United Kingdom away from the European Union. Johnson's challenge now is convincing the British Parliament to get on board before the UK crashes out of the EU at the end of the month. The BBC's Rob Watson joins us now. Rob, welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
Okay, so yesterday the Prime Minister said negotiations with Europe felt like climbing Mount Everest. It appears he's reached the summit as of this morning, but how does his plan address the main sticking point we've all been reading about, the customs arrangement for Northern Ireland?
So here's the problem, that in order to get to that summit, and it was undoubtedly a rather difficult climb, Mr. Johnson has essentially, in many ways, had to sacrifice Northern Ireland's place in the United Kingdom. And what I mean by that is there were always going to be three ways of dealing with the Irish problem after Britain votes to leave the European Union. One is that the UK could have decided to stay very close to the EU economically, stay in its customs union, its single market. That would have just, the problem wouldn't have arisen. Or it could decide to have had a border on the island of Ireland between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. The problem for that is that it was felt it would be a magnet for violence, given the history of problems in Northern Ireland. So the only other alternative was to place an internal border inside the United Kingdom, if you like, so to have a border between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And so in climbing that summit, Mr. Johnson, who'd said he would never, ever do that, he would never sacrifice Northern Ireland's place inside the United Kingdom, he has had to do that. That has then upset this small Northern Irish party, which is potentially going to cause him all sorts of problems.
Yes, speaking of that sacrifice, the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, the DUP, they've already been very vocal saying no to this deal. Can you tell me a little bit more about what they've been saying and their problem with it, which you kind of laid out?
Well, their problem is quite simple, really. It's existential. I mean, if you think about it, they represent a community in Northern Ireland. If one thinks of Northern Ireland as, if you like, disputed territory between a Catholic community who, by and large, would like to see a united Ireland one day, and a Protestant community which, by and large, favours the continued union with the United Kingdom. The Democratic Unionist Party, it represents that. It represents unionism. And they basically think that any form of a deal which basically weakens the economic ties between the province and the rest of the United Kingdom basically undermines unionism. So this gets to the very heart of what it is that they are all about. Now, of course, a lot of people might turn around and say, my goodness gracious, then what on earth were you doing supporting Brexit? What an incredibly foolish thing to do. And you're now getting your comeuppance.
Well, the thing is, though, that Johnson needs the DUP to get behind this deal if he plans to pass it through Parliament. How do you think he's going to handle this roadblock?
Well, you're right. On the face of it, he would. I mean, we've crunched the numbers at the BBC, and it sort of looks as though, because he has a minority government, if he doesn't have the DUP support, that he would fall short of getting a majority for his deal. I mean, I think the only thing that might change that is the following, and it's my sort of formula for trying to figure out what happens on Saturday in this truly historic session of Parliament. I mean, it seems to me it depends on whether enough Conservative MPs who made Theresa May's life hell by rejecting her deal, whether enough of them, the enthusiastic Brexiteers, whether they think, you know what, we're not sure about this deal, we don't like what's happening to Northern Ireland, but hey, we may lose Brexit. I mean, there may be another referendum, who knows, so maybe we'll hold our noses and support it. I think it also depends whether enough MPs who think that Brexit is a truly crazy idea, whether they nonetheless think that some kind of a deal is better than a no-deal Brexit, and that they also take the view that while there'll be an economic hit, that maybe that is slightly less worse than disappointing the 17.4 million people who voted leave. So I think it's that, you know, it's that kind of formula. It's not just about the DUP. It's what will MPs think is the least worst option from their point of view.
But then there's all of this talk about an extension. So Boris Johnson is reportedly asking EU leaders to reject his request for an extension beyond that October 31st date, which he is required by law to ask if Parliament doesn't approve this deal by Saturday, as you said. Give me some insight on this. Will this be enough to scare MPs into voting for Johnson's deal?
Well, I think that's certainly what Mr. Johnson is hoping for, and certainly one senior EU official has said, look, the EU would not want to see an extension. And I think, look, there's no doubt that the European Union would love to get this issue done and dusted as much as Mr. Johnson. And he is certainly hoping that absolutely that that would be part of the sort of the tools for terrifying MPs into voting for this deal, even if they may think it's a very, very imperfect deal indeed, that they just think, crikey, you know, anything is better than no deal. I mean, I'm just not sure whether it's going to work. I mean, I think it might. I think it'll certainly be a consideration for MPs that, hang on a minute, maybe they couldn't be absolutely sure that the EU really would extend the Brexit process.
So much to follow. We thank you so much. The BBC's Rob Watson in London. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and listen out to see what happens on Saturday, everyone.
We will be watching.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Yesterday, we heard about the housing collapse in 2008 and how it created thousands of vacant so-called zombie homes in Cleveland, Ohio. Today, we take a wider view of the housing market. As a new book points out, the 2008 crisis significantly changed the nature of home ownership. It also helped to widen the income inequality gap as a few well-placed bankers were positioned to make a lot of money off of struggling homeowners. The book is aptly called Homewreckers. Its author is Aaron Glantz, who is a senior investigative reporter at Reveal for the Center for Investigative Reporting. And he joins me now from the Reveal studios in Emeryville, California. Aaron, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I actually appear in the acknowledgments of the book because you and I were at the Knight Fellowship Program at Stanford University back in 2016. And real estate and home mortgage lending were actually topics you were interested in even back then.
Yeah, I was interested in knowing why the American people felt so uneasy, right? 2016, when you and I were at Stanford, we were watching the rise of Donald Trump. We were watching the surprising popularity of Bernie Sanders. And so here you had people on both the left and the right who felt that fundamentally the system was not working for them. And so I thought housing would be a good place to look because 8 million people lost their homes in the Great Recession, and they didn't necessarily, you know, have the opportunity to get them back.
Let's talk a little bit about that. You call your book Homewreckers because after that financial crisis, there was a shift from individual home ownership to corporations owning large numbers of homes through these mortgage products. As you said, it was a devastating time for homeowners, but these corporations actually benefited from the collapse.
Well, I'm looking at the cover of my book right now, and you see Steve Mnuchin, who's now the Treasury Secretary, Wilbur Ross, who's now the Commerce Secretary. Both of these people were bankruptcy expert, Wall Street guy, who did not overextend themselves before the housing bust. And so when banks started to go under, when people started to feel rickety, that's when they pounced. Steve Mnuchin put a group together that included George Soros, Michael Dell, the founder of Dell Computer. And when this big Southern California bank called IndyMac failed and the government took it over, they struck a deal with the government where the government basically gave them the bank for $0 and then agreed to subsidize them for any of their losses. So when Steve Mnuchin began foreclosing on families after he acquired this bank, the government, under the terms of this agreement, actually gave him money most of the time when he foreclosed.
How did his actions push people into further turmoil? You actually profile one family in particular.
Under the terms of the deal where he acquired the bank, he's supposed to be helping homeowners hold on to those houses and renegotiate the terms of their loans. But instead, there was this foreclosure machine that he ramped up. So I write extensively about this one woman, Sandy Jolly. Her home of more than 30 years, her family home, before the housing bust, her parents had taken on this reverse mortgage that sapped their equity. This is with the previous owner of the bank. So when Mnuchin took the bank over, he could have made a deal with this family to help them stave off foreclosure and keep their house. But instead, he battled them for years until finally he did foreclose and the house was sold on the auction block. And so that's one type of home wrecker.
But there are four guys on the cover of your book, President Trump, and then three men who you say were also major contributors to his campaign, including Steve Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross. How is he, as you would call him, a homewrecker?
Wilbur Ross did basically the same thing in Florida. He acquired a bank called Bank United off the government during the bust and also got huge subsidies. And now he's the Commerce Secretary. Then down on the lower part of the book, I have Steve Schwartzman, who's the founder of the Blackstone Corporation. He and another Trump associate, Tom Barrack, what they did was after these homes were foreclosed, they went in all around the country and they started buying them up.
But then what happened to these homes?
They became rentals. And these landlords would sign leases where every time they expired, the rent would go up. They would have maintenance agreements where the tenants would have to take on responsibility for trimming the trees or repairing the plumbing, but at the same time, they wouldn't get any of the equity and wealth that usually comes from taking on those responsibilities.
You take great pains to point out, as much as white homeowners suffered in the housing collapse, Black and Latino homeowners were, as a rule, hit much harder. Can you explain more and why?
Well, the African-American homeownership rate in this country today is lower than it was when segregation was legal during the Jim Crow era, when discrimination was legal. And that is because people of color were targeted for the most predatory mortgage products during the housing bubble. And so when the housing bust happened, they were more likely to get foreclosed on. And then when the economy started to get better, and banks started to lend again, it was hard for anyone to get a loan. You know, credit was tight, but it was especially hard for people of color. We started to see this old redlining that was common, you know, decades ago, where, you know, it didn't matter how much money you made or the neighborhood that you wanted to buy in or the amount of debt you were trying to take on in a loan, that people of color were more likely to be turned down for their mortgages. And some of the banks, like, for example, Steve Mnuchin's bank, almost never lent to Black and brown people, even though, you know, Mnuchin's bank was located in Los Angeles, which is, you know, one of the largest, most diverse cities in the country.
In the book, you're quite critical of the Obama administration's response to the plight of homeowners. Explain how that administration's role furthered this anguish that we're talking about.
Well, there were a lot of really good ideas that were floated at a very high level that would have avoided a lot of the things that we talked about. So, for example, during the Great Depression, there was a government-run bank called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. It renegotiated one out of every five home loans in America. It saved a million people's homes. And when it did have to foreclose, it took pains to sell them off to other deserving families one at a time once the Depression had ended. And after World War II, as we know, the government had the GI Bill, and the GI Bill helped millions of World War II veterans buy homes. Both the Homeowners Loan Corporation and the GI Bill did not cost the taxpayers. The Homeowners Loan Corporation made money. The GI Bill basically broke even. And this was debated in the Obama administration. People were suggesting, let's do this again. And those people were just laughed out.
Yeah, Congress passed this massive bailout.
Yeah, Congress passed this huge bailout. They said, oh, we can't afford to help regular Americans. Instead, they gave all the money to the banks.
We should point out, as you do in the book, that many of the people you profile are now in positions of power within either the Trump administration or in his campaign. How have they affected current policy?
They are putting their foot on the gas pedal to rig the economy further in ways that could really harm our ability to have wealth. The average homeowner in America is worth about $200,000. The average renter is worth about $2,000, because most of us spend most of our money on things that just kind of disappear, like gas, we burn it up, clothes, they wear out. Only our housing expenditure has the chance to accumulate wealth for ourselves and our children and maybe even our grandchildren. And what they've been doing is taking many, many steps to make it harder for families to buy homes. So, for example, on the very first day that Trump was in office, he made it more expensive to take out a FHA mortgage, which is a mortgage that the government insures to help working class people buy homes. Steve Mnuchin over at the Treasury Department is changing the rules on this law called the Community Reinvestment Act, which forces banks to lend to low and moderate income people and have branches in working class neighborhoods. The Trump administration is gutting enforcement of the Fair Housing Act, which bans housing discrimination against people of color. So these men, the home wreckers, they are very, very serious about making money. And the way they make money is by profiting off of our pain. And they have been changing a lot of rules behind the scenes without us really noticing.
And yet you end your book on a somewhat optimistic note. Are you hopeful for the future of home ownership in America?
I am optimistic. I'm optimistic because in researching the book, I saw that we've done things in the past that have worked. There's no reason why we as a country can't invest in solutions that are going to make our country more just and fair. And I think that sometimes we just throw up our hands and we think that it has to be this way and that there's no opportunity for change. But you don't spend years writing a book if you think the situation is hopeless. You spend time writing a book because you want to put ideas out there into the world to make the world a better place.
I'm just curious. I remember when you were chasing after Tom Barrack, but Wilbur Ross, Steve Mnuchin, I know you've reached out to all of them. Have you received any responses from them?
No, I haven't been able to get an interview with any of them. I did get interviews with a number of people associated with them, mostly off the record or on background. I sent Steve Mnuchin certified letters to four of his houses saying that I'm still available if he wants to talk to me, that there's a book that calls him a home wrecker. And if he'd like to talk about it, I'd be more than happy to include his perspective.
Aaron Glantz's book is Home Wreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. Aaron Glantz, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Chicago teachers are on strike today, which means no classes for 300,000 students. This is the first major strike in the city since 2012. The strike back then was credited for sparking a national movement in places like Los Angeles, Oklahoma, and West Virginia. For more, let's bring in Adriana Cardona Makigod, who covers education at WBEZ. Hi, Adriana.
Hi, how are you?
So let's talk a little bit about some of the demands, which include lower class sizes, more social workers in schools, and what else are they demanding?
Well, obviously, salary increases are also on the table. Mayor Lori Lightfoot made a recent salary offer, obviously, of 16% raise over 5 years. But the teachers union is not agreeing to salaries at this point until these other issues get resolved. And there is a written commitment in the contract for more nurses, social workers, librarians, class sizes. Now, the CTU wants to decrease the number of students in the classrooms, and they want that to be enforceable as well.
On the subject of salary, Chicago Union Teachers, the median salary is about $75,000 a year. How much does this compare with other cities, other major cities?
Yeah, it's pretty comparable. The average teacher salary in New York is about $79,500, according to a recent report. But, you know, we also have to keep in mind that for veteran teachers, that's the top most experienced teachers. Mm-hmm. They tap out at a lower range compared to other cities. Also here in Chicago, I mean, some people may think, well, that's a pretty good salary. But the living expenses is just getting harder for some people to live in the city of Chicago as rent and mortgage gets, harder to pay for some people.
Right, right. Other things on the negotiating table, you mentioned the lower class sizes, but and more affordable housing for teachers, as you said, that many of them are living outside of the city, but also stronger sanctuary protections for immigrant students. That last one the city has already agreed to, but these are not issues that we've seen in the past.
Yeah, they're definitely not those type of issues that we've seen in the past. But the harsh economic and political realities of today mean that strike negotiations are starting to include more social justice issues. Well, in the city and the district, officials have agreed to more sanctuary protections for immigrant children. What sanctuary schools also mean for teachers is more bilingual resources for the students who are trying to learn English. And you have to keep in mind that our district has a larger or it has a majority of Hispanic students, and many of them do not speak or are learning how to speak the language. We also have schools with a high population of Asian students that need support in their native language as well. So they also think that's important.
Yeah, and many of those school buildings will be open today so that many of those students can still go there, even though this strike is now happening. Adriana Cardona Makigad, education reporter at WBEZ in Chicago. Adriana, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
You probably know big tech companies are under fire for policies allowing misleading or false political ads and violent videos to appear on their platforms. Critics say Facebook and Twitter allow politicians to lie with impunity in their ads, and YouTube has refused to take down a video that's been digitally altered to depict Donald Trump slaughtering political opponents and media figures. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll is here. And John, we also have to add Senator Elizabeth Warren running intentionally a false ad on Facebook. Start there.
Right. Late last week, she posted an ad on Facebook that had the copy, "Breaking news, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook just endorsed Donald Trump for re-election." You're probably shocked and you might be thinking, how could this possibly be true? Well, it's not.
It's not. And she goes on to say Facebook has given Trump free rein to lie on its platform, singles out a Trump ad that makes those false accusations about Joe Biden and his son Hunter, while also attacking the news media.
Right. And the ad's been viewed over 5 million times. Facebook's defense basically is that it's not there. It's not in the business of setting the boundaries of political discourse. And it also says that political speech is not covered by its fact-checking system, and the company is following the FCC guidelines, which say broadcast networks have to run political ads from federal candidates.
Broadcast networks can't reject these ads, but that doesn't apply to cable.
Right. And so CNN, MSNBC, CNBC have all rejected that Trump ad. Essentially, Facebook is choosing the system that works to its advantage from a revenue standpoint, but it's really, this is lunch money to Facebook. You know, Trump has spent about $20 million on Facebook so far. The combined Democratic field has spent about $32 million. Yeah. Facebook takes in $40 billion a year in ad revenue.
So it is lunch money. Look, BuzzFeed just reported that Facebook has taken down more than 160 ads just this month. So what's different about
those? Right. This is technicalities. Ads from about five candidates have been pulled for breaking Facebook rules, mostly regarding profanity or fake buttons that seem interactive but aren't. This is like, you know, a misdemeanor compared to felony lying, but that's what they're doing.
And can we talk about, just in the minute that we have, that violent video that pro-Trump people produced.
Right. It's basically a digitally altered video that shows Donald Trump slaughtering political opponents and media critics. It superimposes his face on the character in the cut. You know, YouTube says basically it's fictional content, and so they don't ban violent content that's fictional. They put an age restriction on it, and they put a warning on it, but basically it's still up there.
Oh, that explains it then, why that's still there. Here now, media analyst John Carroll. Boy, and the election season is just heating up.
It's just starting.
So you will be back. John, thank you. Well, speaking of the election season, how hardened is the political divide in the U.S.? That's the question Stanford researchers wanted to answer. And they also wanted to test their theory that if you put Americans with different views together, they might change their minds. So they put 526 Americans, to be exact, at a resort in Texas for a weekend in September. The nonpartisan group Helena paid for the $3 million weekend. The research institute NORC at the University of Chicago found just the right mix of diverse opinions. And Stanford's researchers dug in as they had conversations about everything from immigration to healthcare. One of those researchers is Stanford's Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. And so, Larry, what was your big takeaway about how this weekend affected people?
I actually think that the single most important thing we found is that after deliberating for 3.5 days with people often who sharply disagreed with them and talking about issues, not candidates and personalities, but immigration, taxes, healthcare, the environment, and foreign policy, the percentage of people who thought our democracy was doing at least reasonably well doubled from 30% to 60%. And then we found that there was significant change in opinion on the issues, that the tendency was for Republicans to edge away from extremely implacably hostile positions on immigration. And Democrats backed away from support for positions on taxation and on spending. For example, universal basic income or the baby bonds proposal that looked like they were going to spend a lot of money that we might not really have.
Huh. So here's another example that we're hearing about. Before these people all sat down together, 83% of Democrats wanted to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That shrank after they spent the weekend together to 59%. Because why? Tell us some of the anecdotes they might have heard, because this was not about them hearing from researchers. This was them about maybe hearing from, what, a small business owner who couldn't afford it or something? What would change their mind? Yeah.
Most of their interaction was with one another in small groups. But then they did hear from experts as well in plenary session. And they also heard a presidential candidate, Michael Bennett, speak to this issue and say, hey, I'd at least like a cutout because for certain regions of the country, because the cost of living isn't the same in every region of the country. And $15 might put a lot of people out of work in some parts of the country.
We're hearing about people who might just be talking one-on-one and someone hears from the other. Boy, Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, made my father go on insurance, and it saved his life because he soon after discovered that he had a certain form of cancer. And that was a story that made someone think twice about the Affordable Care Act. You had Republicans who might have thought it was good for President Trump to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal, but then they changed their minds. What might they have heard?
Well, I think what they heard is experts in this case, even a leading Republican, say they might not have liked every aspect of the deal, but the cost of pulling out was very high, very destabilizing.
Well, and Larry, why do you think this happened? I mean, some people might have seen the supplement in the New York Times this past weekend. The Times decided when they heard about this, like, what? These people are all going to be together. They wanted to take a passport picture. of each of these people, which is kind of what you were doing in a way, taking a photograph of America through these people. Mm-hmm. We hear some of them had to lie to their family about where they were going because they couldn't say they were going to go talk to people of right. different opinions. Do you think it was just people getting off their own information silo and actually coming face to face with other Americans?
I think it wasn't just coming face to face. I think it was the magic of deliberation under good conditions, which don't generally prevail in our country today. And the good conditions were, first of all, we gave them a kind of orienting set of facts and competing arguments on each issue. Second, they had access to competing points of view there. In our plenary sessions, we gave them presidential candidates from the two parties. But third, they heard not only the different arguments of their fellow Americans, but the different life experiences. And when Republicans had to sit in the room and hear actual immigrants talk about their motives for immigrating, there were dramatic changes away from Republican hostility to immigration. Mm. And the percentage of people, particularly Republicans, who were willing to increase visas for skilled workers or unskilled workers, it jumped to 80% of the whole sample from 60% for skilled workers. Mm. And the percentage of Americans who were willing to force undocumented immigrants to return to their home countries before trying to come to the U.S. and seek entry, that declined in our sample from 46 to 25%. Hmm. And this was the result of the fact that Republican support for that proposal through the deliberation process plummeted.
Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and one of the researchers from Stanford behind America in One Room. We'll link you to more of what they found. It's fascinating. Larry, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
So we've spoken with people who have tried this on a smaller scale. What about you? Have you found getting away from your information silo, your social media helps you communicate with others? Or do you find it impossible to talk to Americans on the other side of the political divide? HereNow.org.
The NBA regular season kicks off this coming Tuesday after a preseason dominated by controversy. It started when Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey tweeted out a now deleted message in support of the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. And that put the NBA in an awkward position because the Los Angeles Lakers and Brooklyn Nets were playing exhibition games in China. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver defended Morey's right to speak out. The league then canceled press conferences in China. And when Lakers star LeBron James returned to the U.S. from those exhibition games, he had this to say about Morey.
We all talk about this freedom of speech. Yes, we all do have freedom of speech. But at times there are ramifications for the negative that can happen. When you're not thinking about others, you know, you're only thinking about yourself. So I don't want to get into a word or sentence feud with Daryl Morey, but I believe he wasn't educated on the situation at hand.
And we'll get to those ramifications. We have Mike Pesca here with Here and Now sports analyst. He's host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
So we spoke with you when this controversy first started, and it raised a lot of questions about freedom of speech and repression in China. But it also revealed something that many of us may have not known, that there's so much money at stake here. China loves basketball, and the NBA has billions of dollar deals there. I want to know, what's your takeaway?
Yeah, and China loves basketball, and the team that they loved either most or second most was the Houston Rockets, because the great center Yao Ming played for the Rockets, and now Chinese broadcasters aren't even playing Rockets games. The NBA, like many American companies, does have this huge market in China, and it's a growing market. But unlike a lot of companies which maybe have to ship actual products or have a production center there, all the NBA has to do is play a game and then hit a button, and those games get transmitted to China, and the NBA gets hundreds of millions of dollars. So they don't want to jeopardize the deal. But at the same time, they were also the league that encouraged, not just allowed, but encouraged their players and employees to speak out. And I have to say, because LeBron James didn't, and Adam Silver didn't, it's not just this freedom of speech. It's a freedom of conscience, or it's a moral question. And LeBron James just glided over that. Well, he talked about people not being smart or being ignorant and not knowing. I mean, it's not that hard a question, which is that the people of Hong Kong are being oppressed by an autocratic regime. When Daryl Morey pointed that simple thing out, all holy hell was unleashed to the surprise of the NBA. So what we have now is LeBron James, a guy who prides himself on being politically outspoken, saying, let's not speak on this because you could hurt feelings or not know what you're talking about.
But he also has a lot at stake with China. We know that he has a business interest. He's his sponsor, Nike. It's the third largest market, China is. And he has all of these entertainment projects like the upcoming movie Space Jam 2, which actually might be distributed in China. So what kind of blowback are we seeing against what he said?
Yeah, I mean, he has teammates who he wants to have good relations with who literally have shoe deals with Chinese companies. And he's a gigantic Nike endorsee, I guess. He has a huge contract, and therefore there's money on the line. And if you don't think that Space Jam 2 means anything or can make a lot, I mean, one movie, the last Avengers movie, made $600 million in China.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, he had there's a lot on the line. And unlike some of the other times when he spoke up, like when he endorsed Hillary Clinton for president and when he called Donald Trump literally a bum, there really wasn't a cost to him. That's not off his brand. In fact, you could say people maybe liked LeBron James, or the people who were his consumers already liked LeBron James more. It's 180 degrees different with China.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the NBA season with the little bit of time we have with you. Speaking of LeBron James, let's start with the Lakers. In his first year with the team last season, they didn't even make the playoffs. Do you think that's going to change this season?
Well, that stain of nothing will change the past. But what will change the future is Anthony Davis, the great New Orleans Pelican center, will be there. In an effort to acquire Davis, LeBron pretty much blew up the chemistry of the team, making it known he didn't quite like his current teammates. That's something LeBron will do. But with those two guys, those are the best two players, 1-2 punch in the West in the NBA. And right now, I just looked at the odds. They're the second favorite to win it all. So make the playoffs? Yes. I say you could slot them in right now unless there's an injury or a gigantic injury or two.
Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley at NPR West in Culver City, California.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.